Welcome to the WeatherPod, a podcast about the growing importance of weather information to business and society. I'm Alan Thorpe. I'm a former Director General of the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts, a former head of the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre, and a professor of meteorology.
And I'm David Rogers. I'm a former chief executive of the UK Met Office and am now a consultant with the World Bank, helping countries improve their weather-related disaster management systems and services.
Weather information is a critical international resource for saving lives, making business and society more efficient, and building resilience to extreme weather and climate change.
In each episode, we invite a leading expert to discuss how public, private, and academic sectors work together to produce weather information and make it available to business and society.
We also investigate how weather-affected public and private enterprises actually use it and the new business opportunities being created.
And because extreme weather often impacts the poorest the hardest, we'll look beyond the rich countries to the less developed ones, which host most of the world's population. Today it's our pleasure to welcome Professor Alberto Troccoli, Managing Director of the World Energy and Meteorology Council and Visiting Professor at the University of East Anglia, to the WeatherPod. Previously, Alberto worked at NASA, ECMWF, the University of Reading, and CSIRO. He's published extensively on weather and climate risks, authored a number of books including Weather Matters for Energy and Weather and Climate Services for the Energy Industry. He's also the convener of the International Conference of Energy and Meteorology. Alberto, a big welcome to the WeatherPod.
Yes, welcome, Alberto. Many thanks for coming along today.
It's my pleasure to be here with you, Alan and David.
So, Alberto, perhaps you could start by telling us briefly about the Energy and Meteorology Council, its vision, mission, and who are its members?
Yes, thanks. So the World Energy Meteorology Council is set up as a non-profit. Essentially, it's a company limited by guarantee established in the UK in 2015. The connection and the support from the University of East Anglia, and it's still based on campus at the University of East Anglia. So we like to keep that connection with the university, but there's no particular preference for the university. We want to be able to reach out to all research organizations and energy industry to provide support for use of best weather and climate for energy, for sustainable energy, low carbon economy, and enhance resilience of energy infrastructure.
Do your activities involve developing countries?
Yes, they do. In fact, we have an MOU with WMO. We work very closely with WMO. We work also with the World Bank. And so we've done several activities in various parts of the world, including Africa and working on South America now and various other places. So, yes.
Great. Thanks, Alberto. I wanted just to move on to essentially the needs of the energy sector for meteorological information. And I wondered, I suppose, particularly we're talking about renewable energy here. How would you sort of describe the specific needs of the energy sector for weather and climate information? And I suppose by that kind of information, I'm talking about all sorts, whether it be observations, analyses, or forecasts. What are really the needs of the renewable energy sector for this kind of information?
Well, the needs are really broad, and it is now much more evident with renewable energy, of course, but use of weather and climate information by the energy industry has been happening for decades because, you know, it's part of many activities in energy, not only renewables, including the exploration. So when you go out at sea, you know, we need to have a good forecast for the vessels. And also to produce demand forecasts. So this has been obviously something that has been part of how we live for a while in terms of how we use energy, depending on how the climate is, whether it's hot and so on. So in that sense...
Alberto, could you give us a sketch as to, you know, you mentioned forecasts for demand management. What kind of forecasts are we talking about? What time range are we talking about? You know, what are the specific kind of meteorological data that are perhaps most crucial?
In terms of demand forecast, the most crucial one, of course, is temperature. And the range of forecast is anywhere from, let's say, seconds, minutes to longer term, because you want to know how you balance the grid for, you know, a few minutes ahead and how to plan a few years ahead. So there are there also variables that are important, like wind speed or solar radiation in some cases, or humidity, but temperature is definitely the main one.
Alberto, am I right in thinking that if we transition to full use of renewables, I mean, to decarbonize our economies, and we're looking at renewable as the main source of electricity, is there going to be a more demand for weather information and monitoring on the production side?
Yeah, absolutely. The increase in requests for forecasting, for example, for renewable energy is obviously increasing as the share of renewables increases. There's more and more need for various reasons. But the main one, I guess, is that people are concerned about balancing the grid. And therefore, you need to know how much energy is being produced at any one time, so you can balance that appropriately with demand, and that requires, you know, production of forecast of wind speed and therefore wind power and solar radiation. But we also need to bear in mind that the actual and current use of renewable energy in general is not that high at the moment. So the demand is increasing, but it will be much higher when we get to higher levels.
You've mentioned timescales like seconds and minutes for this kind of the need for this kind of information on that timescale. But on the other hand, actually, weather forecasts for you know, very local regions are very difficult. Actually, I mean, and typically, we're not really able yet to produce forecasts on you know, really short timescales and really small space scales. So I'm just kind of trying to connect, in a sense, with what data that we can produce today from the meteorological centers and whether that's really fit for purpose at the moment.
Yeah, that's a very interesting area of innovation, actually, because I guess you, Alan, have more in mind the traditional kind of weather forecasting coming from a numerical weather prediction model. But that's right. But the innovation has moved on quite a bit now, and it has to do that because you know, the companies producing this kind of electricity have to have a good handle on what is being produced at any one time. And so what happens is that they started building and installing their own observations, first of all. So on you will find that on wind turbines, you have a wind anemometer in each one of them on nacelle, so at the top of the wind tower, there is a wind measurement. And then all these wind measurements are collected together with other measurements, temperature and so on, whatever is relevant, including, you know, you can use oscillometers to measure the height of clouds at the sites. Or LIDAR. So there is all sorts of measurements. And this will then feed different kind of forecasting models, typically statistical models, but they are also combined with numerical weather prediction. So what's been done basically is to find how to blend all these observations, all the statistical models with the numerical weather predictions in order to achieve the best skill, the best accuracy at any one lead time, and This is actually, there's quite a lot of development in this space, including, you know, with the latest machine learning, artificial intelligence models.
So if you come back to the decarbonization, and as you've said, I mean, renewables have not, they're penetrating the market, but they're not certainly taking over the market yet. But assuming that they do you see, is there a significant change in the way the market will be structured? And there are two questions I wanted to ask related to this. Is one, does it put more burden on the producer to promise a certain supply, and therefore the producer needs to really understand their capacity to actually generate energy at any given moment? And then second, also, is there a potential for increasing electrification in places where using renewables you could actually have a more of a distributed grid rather than a centralized production, but rather it's a lot of smaller suppliers and creating a market in a local markets for energy? Is that also possible?
Yeah, so to answer your first question, the burden in a way is already with producing companies. So the wind power companies or the solar power companies or hydropower companies, they need to know, or it's in their interest to know how much they're going to produce at any one time, like I was saying before. And that's why they have all these observations on site, because they are going to bid on the market. And although I think in most markets at the moment, renewables like wind and solar are given priority because they are considered zero cost production. So there is a merit order scale, and they come in the market first, but still they need to bid on that market. And if they produce too much, they need to shed some of the load, or indeed they get curtailed by the regulators or the market operators. And so they need to be careful what they produce. By careful, I mean that they need to know exactly what they produce so they can tell what they're going to provide. And then that obviously needs, again, to match demand. So that's always the target, to know what is going to be needed at any one time. So it's no good to produce a lot of solar power, in very sunny day when you expect the demand not be so high, like in a so-called DAC shape demand, where you get the drop in demand during the day, and instead you get this increase in solar power. And so these are all the headaches that the market operators are facing now, because of in some places there are so large in use of solar power, for instance. And that leads to the second question, because what is already happening in many countries where there's been subsidies, like starting from Germany, but then Italy and also Australia, and to an extent even in the UK, they are talking about distributed solar power. This is mainly for solar power, so the rooftop solar. There's been such a dramatic increase in when the subsidies were on, that basically the grid was forced to accept all this power coming from all the distributed sources. So that created issues with the balancing, and obviously it was very difficult to predict. This is something that is one of the main challenges actually in prediction, because there are so many elements, so many sources of power distributed, and they all have different characteristics, and there's no unique database which tells you, this power generator is such and such, and it's located at this position with this orientation. So there's so many variables that make the prediction very difficult, and that's what the market operators have been facing. And so they they've moved on from the subsidies, and now they are also thinking about reducing the amount of power that this rooftop solar can provide to the grid, because they can cause problems when there is too much coming in.
So just to pick up on that, David, you working in quite a few developing countries like Sri Lanka, to name one, do you think this local market, the flourishing of potentially local markets for renewables, do you think that's something that's liable to take off?
I think it's a huge potential, because one, in many countries the grid is not so robust. So for Sri Lanka as a case, I mean, the grid is it exists and there is a national grid, but there are power cuts because it doesn't operate very efficiently. And the notion that perhaps with a bit of investment you could actually create a local market, so it's rather the local grid as opposed to a national grid. It doesn't, I mean, in a way, I guess to ask Alberto, is that it doesn't stop you having the same problems, but perhaps it means that you at least can extend the access to energy in places. What are your feelings about that, Alberto?
Yes, of course. That is one solution. I mean, there's been various projects also funded by the World Bank. I know some in the Pacific Islands, in this side of the world, in near Australia, where they attempted to create kind of island systems and see to what extent you can sustain that. And of course, you need storage for that, and at the moment the main source of storage is batteries, but in any case, not just for this island systems, you still need storage, and that's the kind of holy grail at the moment, because in order for the variable renewables to really take off, you need that kind of backing that is not provided by the traditional sources, if you wish. Of course, you could always use some of the traditional, but many ways in which this is being looked at is electrical storage, but also pumped hydro storage where you can. So, I mean, locally, most places, even in Australia, which is not very high in altitude, you can build artificial, any dam is artificial, in fact, but you build this kind of dams where you store the water you need electrify the your users when there's not enough wind or solar, let's say. So it is something that is certainly could be used in developing countries which are still lacking the grid, and therefore that's a way to leapfrog the system, and you don't need to go through a national grid in order to provide electricity. So this is quite something that is achievable in principle, but the question, as I said, is the storage, how you produce the technology, not produce the technology, but that you apply the technology in order to get a stable production of electricity, given the variable sources that would come normally from wind and solar.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Alberto, I wanted just to pick up on a point you made, which is very interesting, I think, and that is that the renewable sector, the energy, renewable energy operators are, of course, they are making local meteorological measurements, weather and climate measurements. And actually, those are clearly going into their own local statistical models and also merging and blending with NWP. One of the aspects, though, that we've talked about in the weather pod quite often is that, the numerical weather predictions from the major centers really benefit hugely if those kind of local data, which typically don't go into the sort of initial conditions for the forecasts, but they are terribly important to provide verification data so that, in a sense, the centers can see where the errors are coming from in their numerical weather predictions. And there's a very sort of virtuous feedback loop there between, you know, the ability of the centers to provide to the energy sector good forecasts, and equally the energy providers making accessible the observations to validate the models. However, I just wonder and worry that maybe these data from the energy companies are, in a sense, commercial in confidence. And are they willing to and happy to provide these data widely so that the national centers can and other centers can benefit from them?
So they obviously, this is a very important matter, and it's something that I've actually worked on and off for many years, because you know, I was working, for example, at CSIRO in Australia, and we were collecting all the solar radiation available in Australia, and it turned out that you know, the Bureau of Meteorology, of course, has very high quality data, but they're only a dozen stations, and now probably less than that, because they are very subject to the funding. And so we found many places, other places, and it's not just the energy companies. Actually, you find that agricultural station, they have a lot of solar radiation that could be very useful for both the energy, but also the weather forecast, like you're saying. And then you start to do this work and you find that, yeah, some data can be obtained, but then the characteristics are not quite as you'd expect, because for example, the resolution is not good enough. But more than that is the quality, because often you need to spend a lot of time trying to clean the data when it is available. In the cases of energy companies, though, most of the time they're not available, and partly is because of commercial sensitivities, and that's that it is an obstacle, and it's not, I don't think there is a clear solution yet. But the other aspect is that even if this energy companies were to share the data, there would be an expected or likely burden on them, because not only do they need to provide the data, they would also need to kind of offer support to explain, you know, where is this data, and that's what they most companies also want to avoid, to be you know, end up spending a lot of time trying to answer questions about this data, because obviously, you know, the it's important to have the data, but then you also need to have a good quality, or at least understand where the drawbacks or the limitations of the data are. And that exchange turns out to be quite costly, at least according to the discussions I've had with many companies. We also set up, like for a while, a working group with Wind Europe, and for the exact purpose to, you know, engage with wind industry companies to see whether they were happy to share this data. And unfortunately, that didn't go very far. So the most recent and promising innovation in this respect is some kind of economic models that basically allow people to share the data and to get some kind of return, which could be an economic return if the data are used in such a way that raise some funds. So there is a group that I know of, but there's probably now a few more, because this activity started a few years ago, and they are trying to optimize this kind of exchange models. So that's I think the most promising path I can see in order for companies to share. Otherwise, the only other way that you know, research and community has benefited from this is through one-to-one or maybe one-to-two or whatever non-disclosure agreements. So you use the data for a while, you improve and you get the information you want, but then you most of the time you can't even publish the data because they are under this non-disclosure agreements.
So this sort of leads to also how you use products like the reanalysis from numerical weather prediction centers. I mean, how useful is this? Well, I assume it's useful that you're constantly updating the climatology, and if you have access to additional additional data, that's obviously going to help improve the verification and subsequently improve the reanalysis and so forth. How is that kind of information used from a point of view of locating renewable energy sites in different countries?
Yeah, I think reanalysis is hugely important in planning and not so much financing, but there are different levels of planning in wind and solar particularly. And so it comes, the first step is to have a broad idea where you want to go. And then you, once you find that, you go deeper in that. So reanalysis help with the first step to work out roughly where you get the best resource. But not only that, because then reanalysis is also used for as a boundary condition, as a constraint to the higher resolution models, because of course you can't run the higher resolution models at the resolution you need for the financing, which you require resolutions of 100 meters or less, actually probably 10 meters or something. And so you use the reanalysis as a boundary condition for all these models, and normally you actually go through two steps. So you do the mesoscale, so where you go to maybe tens of kilometers resolution and or less, and then microscale modeling where you go to 100 meters or less. So reanalysis are always there, and the thing that they brought in actually also is the ability to extend the time series. So not just having this global view and be able to constrain the models at the spatial scale, but also to have an idea of the variability over many, many years. Because when, you know, like 10, 15 years ago, when the first solar power plants and before that, the wind power farms were financed, they were relying on observed data on site. And because you couldn't wait too long, then people were happy to accept maybe a year or two of data. That even if they were local and so very representative of the site, you had obviously not enough knowledge about the long-term variability. And so a lot of surprises came up because you were measuring wind or in a period when, let's say, El Nino was on, and then you find out if you got effects from ENSO in that region, and then you find out that the what you produce is very different from what you planned. So that's where, you know, reanalysis has also been very helpful, because they give this long-term perspective over 40 and now even 70 years with ERA 5. And so that's been, you know, a kind of game changer in the industry.
Does machine learning and AI come into this in terms of downscaling and...
So machine learning and AI at the moment are mainly used for short-term predictions. So what by short-term, I mean the minutes to hours, like we were talking about before. So, and then you blend these models with numerical weather predictions as you move on, and also with satellite data in some cases where you can use it. So like, you know, satellite data are used for tracking clouds, for example, which are used for solar power predictions. But the machine learning are most useful. That's basically how they function. They need a lot of data, so they're very data hungry, and the most amount of data are available when you are looking at short-term predictions, because you can accumulate a lot of the observations in that time range. They become less useful when you extend the range particularly when you go to seasonal forecast, when you have fewer cases, the statistics become slimmer and they're well less supported in that regard. But there is certainly a huge wave of new developments and innovation in machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I expect, you know, for example, also with patents, it's not just time series prediction, is also looking at patents and perhaps as an addition to what is being done with satellite, but also we didn't talk about sky cameras, for example. Sky cameras is another innovation that have in the field of solar power, which started about, let's say, 7-8 years ago, maybe 10. And this is very, very important for the short-term prediction, because obviously you can see, you know, the clouds moving and so on. So order of seconds to a few hours, the sky cameras are really, really useful. And by coupling this also with machine learning that allows you to map the patterns or the images, then I'm sure this is going to be a very powerful innovation.
You're listening to WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Alberto, I'd like to just move topic slightly in the conversation. We know the weather value chain is, you know, at the user end of the value chain, sort of falls into two sort of distinct parts. One is where weather information is tailored for specific uses, say by the energy sector. So it's very much, we talked about, for example, downscaling, and you just talked about patterns of clouds, etc. So there's ways in which the weather data can be tailored to better give information for the energy sector. But there's increasingly a second area which we could call integrated services, where we actually think about merging together, not just the weather information, but also, for example, you know, the energy demand data and also the energy supply data into a more integrated model that would enable, you know, more efficient and effective use of renewable energy. And I'm just curious to know, do you think that area of the development of, you know, merging bigger data sets in integrated services, is that something that you see as an opportunity?
Yes and no, in the sense that this kind of developments are normally done by large companies. So as you can imagine, the more complex the problem, and when you try to merge or blend demand, you know, combine the demand, the supply from various sources, it becomes more complex, the problem. So the thing is that for such a service or model to be useful, it needs to be very realistic. And in order to be very realistic, you need to have a lot of complexity, which is what the grid has. And, you know, that it's not just about what kind of power goes in, it's you know, all the obstructions on the grid and downtimes, maintenance and so on. So it's a very complex kind of modeling, and so normally this is done at either large company levels, like say the EDF for France or Enel for Italy, and more globally as well. Or done or supervised by national grid operators like National Grid in UK and so on. So, and for Europe, there is also another body that actually coordinates activities across all the transmission operators, which is called ENSTOE, so the European Transmission Operators Organization. And so it's only when you get to that you know, you get that kind of scale that you can manage the complexity of these models. So what's happening, for example, in terms of the service that I was mentioning, the climate service for the energy sector provided by Copernicus. We provide the elements, we provide the climate data that is useful. We also convert them into demand and supply, but it would be too big a task for people with, like I said, with climate knowledge, but not the knowledge of the operations, day-to-day operation, to be able to provide a solution, a practical solution to this problem.
When you say it's a big task, and of course, in many respects, you're absolutely right, it is. But I think members of the, if you like, the artificial intelligence machine learning community and the data analytics side would say, actually, that complexity is something that's becoming feasible. And actually, the benefits of merging these and bringing these data sets together, while it might be complex, actually the benefits could outweigh that. And so, and I guess it's a personal view from my side, is yes, it's, as you say, very complex, but also represents a medium term opportunity to really take matters forward.
Yes, I mean, I it's good to be challenged, and I know, you know, there's the future Earth, destination Earth. Yes, that's right. Thanks. Yeah. So I'm aware of the ambition of programs like Destination Earth, and you know, it's very good that they try this. But even then, the emphasis is more on improving the kind of output in terms of meteorology, or rather than the application. I know that there is talks about reaching expanding the boundaries and so on, but in a sense, it becomes, I think it's still too complex, and this, the complexity also is to do with commercial sensitivities and so on. So that's, you know, for example, we have been working closely in a European project called Cecliferm with Enel, and we were never put in a position where we could see what was done by the conversion models that take climate data into energy data, because that's handled in a confidential manner, commercially sensitive manner, by the company, which is, yeah, like I said, it's because there's so many years of knowledge and they build their business on that. And to me, I mean, it would be very, very hard, if not impossible, to break that kind of chain. And that would be the same for other sectors. So it's, as I said, it's laudable, the fact that we want to provide the best service for various sectors, but we, from the meteorology perspective, I mean, we also need to realize that there is a lot of complexity out there that we cannot solve by just throwing a lot of computer power, a lot of, you know, new innovation and so on. So that's where I think we there is a limit.
I think that's a very cautionary note, actually, Alberto.
But I think when we think about integrated services, in a way we are talking about just what you've described, is that this information is brought together in a place where you can make a decision. So that is done within a large company, but they have to have access to the right information, and these streams of information have to flow into that system. So that is where it's being integrated. And I think it's the distinction here between the kind of services, the tailored services of the meteorologist of the past, where the meteorologist hands over information about meteorology, and the integrated service, when the user of the information is pulling that information into a system that they're operating, is more what we're talking about when we talk about integrated services. It's not this, it's a relationship that's changed dramatically, that, you know, you're going to effectively, as a company, you're going to have the skill sets available to you internally, and the information has to be available to you to make those decisions. And clearly the energy sector is effectively a prime example of utilizing integrated services, as opposed to the past of tailored services. The meteorologist provides the product and the user then takes that. So I think that's actually a positive example. It moves on also to this notion that the key theme of our weather pods, and that's the relationship between public, private, and academic sectors. Within the global weather enterprise, we each has a role to play. The roles are not strictly defined. I mean, there are blurs between them, and clearly your own organization, the World Energy and Meteorology Council, kind of recognizes that. You sit within a university, the UEA, you engage with the private sector, you also are working with the World Meteorological Organization and the public meteorological sector. So a question for you is how do you see these relationships evolving in the future as the whole energy sector changes? And I mean, will it restructure in a way that will be different from where it is today? I mean, how do you view it?
Yeah, so that's a very exciting area that we're also working on, and it links back to what we were saying before in terms of integrated services. So I think one thing about integrated services that the term itself may create confusion, because integrated gives a sense that you bring everything together under one umbrella, which is not what actually happens in practice. And so I think the important thing is to understand where the boundaries are. So when you work with the industry, one of the first thing you want to know is, what is required, and where do we start, where do you stop, and how do you create this communication and flow of information, and how it can best flow from one to the other. And that's what we've been working on at WEMSI. So most of the work we do and projects, including the one I mentioned before, but others as well, is about this, which is kind of new terminology, if you wish, in particularly in the area of climate services, is this co-design, co-development, and even co-production. And so what it means is basically that you get this much closer relationship and conversation with the industry, and I think that's what we're helping also to do with our organization, is to create a closer link, so that there's more clarity about what is possible from the meteorology community, so that you avoid, people from the industry coming there and say, oh yeah, I want that temperature on that building at that particular time of day 10 years from now, and it has an accuracy of 5% or something, and that's, I guess, a bit how it started, because you were getting all this kind of sometimes absurd, but they're absurd because obviously there's not enough information shared and enough discussion. And so by having this closer conversation, the system becomes more efficient, because you don't have to go back and forth and say, oh, I want that. No, that's not available. You get that instead, and all this thing. So a lot of these conversations have happened, are happening, and it's helping that link. Having said that, we go back to the point of where the boundaries are. And so, we can create a better flow and improve the efficiency of the information after the flow and provide the best information we can. But ultimately, there is a place where meteorology needs to know where to stop, and then hand in the keys, if you wish, of a brand new car to the industry, so they can drive in a safer and faster way.
You've mentioned keys, and I want to just say we've covered some really key topics today in this conversation, Alberto, and really about the value of weather and climate information for the energy sector, renewable energy in particular, of course. So it really only remains for me to say thank you so much, Alberto, for taking part in this. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah, it was great talking with you, David and Alan, and have a great rest of the day and week.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Weather Pod. We hope you've enjoyed it. Alan and I will be back next month, and in the meantime, please give us your feedback via email to support@gweforum.org.